Good morning, everybody. My name is Kancho. I'm a student here at the Zendo. I'm still a noob to Dharma Talks. But it's wonderful to be here and to welcome you all, familiar faces and not so familiar faces. And I think it's traditional, I think, for everybody who gives a Dharma talk to usually welcome everybody here. And that's kind of the theme of what I wanted to talk about this morning, is the welcoming space that is this Sangha, that is this Zendo. It's particularly poignant for me because I'm going to be moving further away. I'm moving about 2 hours north of the city. And so I have to think really, really hard about making the effort to get here. Well, you don't have to think hard, I just have to do it, you know, so we can just get here. So when it comes to Sangha in particular, I wanted to talk about it, and then when you start to think about it, it's like a Pandora's box of stuff. It's like one thing after another and after another. And I can only really touch on the subject briefly, but and I want to touch it in terms of my own experiences as a student when I first came here. I came here on Monday evenings. We had beginning instruction then, and we have it today. But back then it was a little different. It was kind of like a three-period sit, like a regular evening. And those who were new were shepherded into the back room there and given a crash course in Zazen, and then were shepherded back out, usually for the last period. And once you'd been through that experience, you basically came on a Monday nights and you just sat down and you had three uninterrupted, deep periods of Zazen. It really suited me down to the ground because I didn't have to really talk to all that many people. And if I had a question, I could just ask one of the senior students afterwards. And, you know, I came a lot, and I remember Kando being there a lot, too, at that period as well. I got to know a few people, but just a little bit. And increasingly, they would say, well, you know, maybe that's a question you should ask a teacher. We're not teachers. You should ask a teacher that. Of course, typically I've gone completely off topic. My motivations for coming, my original motivations for coming, were not the noblest, really. I couldn't afford therapy, and I was very, very anxious. And someone said, you know, meditation's probably going to be good. And I said, yeah, I read some books on Zen. And then a friend of mine actually just let it slip, Sogan, he let it slip that, I'm a member of the village Zendo, and I come here, obviously, they're a great group of people. And I said, well, where are they? They're 10 minutes from where I live. I'm there. So I came here on Monday nights, and I took what I liked, and I left the rest. You know, no black robes for me, you know. I just wanted to learn the mechanics. I wanted to get rid of that anxiety. I wanted to be, you know, able to kind of function well. And so I was really, really kind of earnest about that. And, you know, one of the study texts we had a few years ago was the Fugan Sazengi, which is Dogen's kind of how-to manual on how to sit Zazen. And it's a wonderful piece. It's very short, and it was written as a letter to a student actually who lived far away. And what really jumps out at you, it's not just the fact that he lays out the mechanics, if you like, of Zazen. It's the deep sincerity and desire for this guy to really do a good job, just to really kind of have a good experience with the Zazen. You really do feel Dogen's compassion just coming out at you on the page. Now, right off the bat, he said, the vehicle of reality is the self. The way is never separated from where we are now. He asks us, how can people today refrain from practice? Cease studying words and following letters. Learn to step back, turning the light inwards, illuminating the self. Doing so, your body and mind will drop off naturally, and original self will manifest. If you wish to attain suchness, practice suchness immediately. Well, I kind of, you know, I found that out a few years later after I first came around. I kind of had a willful sort of ignorance about Zen at that time. I didn't know who Dogen was, hadn't a clue about anything like that, really. I had read a book called How to Teach Yourself Zen. You know, the one thing I really got out of that was how to do kinhin. That was really... I've jumped ahead of myself, which is great. There was only two points in my life when I've been a disciplined person, and one was when I was in college. I had no choice in the matter. I was training to be an actor, and time is money in showbiz. And if you're late, you're screwed. And I apologize for being late this morning. Actually, it was a 5K race, had me sitting in a tailback for like 15 minutes. And I made the mistake then of trying to get around it, and that made things worse. So I missed the first period. But that would be unconscionable in my drama school. If I did that more than once, I'd be cut from the program. I doubt you could get away with that today, but that's the way it was back then. But you know, I had a schedule. I had a fixed schedule, and I knew what time to get up at in the morning, and I knew what needed to be done, and I knew where I needed to be. And after a while, I didn't have to worry about so much except just going forward and doing what I needed to do, which was to go and learn the craft of acting. And it's funny, it's when we're on retreat, we have a schedule as well. And it's similar, I mean, you could say the same about a job or what have you, but it's very, very particular on a retreat. It's the same thing every day. Usually after the first day, you know what's what. And then you don't really have to worry about where you need to be when, you just do it. And that gives you that space to go deep in your practice. We can only do that in community. We can't only. You can you can be very, very severe on yourself and write yourself a schedule and put it on the wall of your house and follow it if you like. But I doubt very many people do that. And the second time I've been disciplined about anything was this practice. And it's curious to me, for somebody who's a bit unfocused and sloppy a lot of the time, I was, after maybe a couple of months, I was kind of thinking, wow, I'm doing this every day, and why? And I realized it's because I'm coming here and there are other people doing it too. And it's not that I feel I owe it to them, but they are helping me, and I like them, and you know, they're a very, very supportive bunch of people, and you know, that really helped a lot, because I know that without that I would have given up, especially because I hadn't quite yet found a position that really suited me. I was in a lot of knee pain or hip pain or whatever, and I think if I'd stayed on my own, I'd been looking for drugs on the corner or something to calm down. There was funny, I thought about this just as I came in this morning. There's a Beatles song, "I'm Digging a Hole," you know. There's a line in the, it's in Sergeant Pepper's. I'll read the line because I can't, I won't sing it, I'm terrible. When the rain came down, I was fixing a hole to stop my mind from wondering where it will go. You know that song. And I often think of Zazen as kind of like digging a hole. We're all digging a hole together, you know. But for what reason, who knows? We're just digging, digging, digging. And there's always more earth to be pulled out. And it's an easier task when done with other people. And also, the Fugen Zazenge was written in the 12th century, or 13th century. That means that people were digging the holes then, and we're digging holes again today. And we're doing the same thing, and that's incredible. It's been passed, the torch has been passed down. That urgency to put that fire out on top of our heads. As human beings, we're pack animals, so we kind of tend to do things better in groups. I mean, there are, of course, individual people who do great things, but generally speaking, if you look at their work, they've done it in groups. I think of Shakespeare. I don't know how Shakespeare wrote those plays. He was a genius. But he was an actor and had a brilliant bunch of actors. and he wrote for them. So that was a collaborative effort. But we evolved as a group, in groups, and we cleaved to clans and tribes and nations and blood and soil and rubbish like that. But that's naturally, that's in our makeup as animals. And you know, to think that we do things alone is even kind of an absurdity when you look at the science today as well. I mean, Neil Sotin often talks about this in his talks, but we're 52% of our DNA is bacteria. It's not us. It's like we're walking ecosystems. So we depend on that, those bacteria and enzymes and what have you, just to be who we are. It's a very strange thing to start thinking about, actually. Where does your human bit end and your bacteria bit begin? But, you know, in Zen literature, we can become enamored with this idea of the lofty genius on the hill and his or her grass hut, you know, sitting alone. Now, but when you look at the stories, people are always seeking them out, knocking on their doors and annoying them. Or otherwise, they're coming down and they're annoying other people. They're coming in and saying, no, I think of Iron Grindstone Lou and Joshu. Joshu was like in his 80s when he did the... when he became the head of that monastery. And he'd yet to kind of, you know, we'd yet to record his famous koans at that point. There was a famous video of Elizabeth Warren a few years ago saying about how you can't do things alone. You know, she talks about your taxes paying for the roads and this, that, and the other, and, you know, And that's a kind of a trite way of looking at the thing, but it's pretty true, though. There's nothing that we do truly alone. Except perhaps, let me take you back to the beginning instructions when I first came here. One night Howard was giving the instruction, and it's not often that we talk about the actual stuff that makes up our ritual and our liturgy and what have you. But he was asked a question, and he talked about the three jewels. I can't remember exactly what context this was in, but he did say that of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, he said, I think the Sangha is the most important. And I was like, come on, are you kidding me? You mean, if I've got to do this practice, I've got to do bake sales and, you know, start soliciting relatives for money and stuff? I don't want to do that. The Sangha is important? No, that's just a trick to get us to come here. So I held up, even though I dropped the notion of, for the record, I've never known of a bake sale ever to happen here or anybody to ask me to go and ask Uncle Richard for money. But I kind of held on to that community. I was very suspicious of community. And the reason, I think, is my upbringing. I grew up in Ireland, and I grew up in a country that had not really resolved itself as a country. It still had this idea that it was broken apart or what have you. But still, so people tended to cleave to these notions of I am Irish and I stand for Irishism or whatever that is. There was even groups within that, like people who spoke Irish who felt they were more Irish than people who didn't speak Irish. At the same time, there's this revulsion toward nationalism because nationalism was killing people. Just a few hundred miles from your door, people were dying. So it was like, I in particular, growing up, felt I didn't want to belong to any group. If I started dressing a particular way and started following a particular, I was a goth for about 10 seconds. And then when other people became a goth, I was like, I'm not going to become a goth. I'm going to get rid of this stuff. But that in and of itself is about being part of a group. I'm part of one of those. You know, Morrissey is the great example of that kind of person, you know, spending warm summer days indoors, writing frightening verse to a bucktooth girl in Luxembourg. That was my sort of teenage years, you know, aloof from everybody. We live in the society that, at the same time, we live in a society that fetishizes the individual. life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's great. You know, I think there's nothing really necessarily wrong with that at heart. I came to the States and I chose to become an American, so I've got one up on all of you guys, except for maybe Josh. When I came here first, I was relieved at the anonymity that I could experience in New York City. I could walk out, I could hang out with some people, but I could walk out of that building and suddenly nobody knew me from Adam. Whereas if I was in Dublin, I couldn't walk down the street without saying, oh Jesus, there's Mike, I don't want to talk to him today. But here it was very much, you know, you're just a walking head, you know, among walking heads, and you disappear into the crowd. And I loved that. I loved that. And I was one of those people that eschewed that kind of, I didn't hang out with Irish people when I came here, put it that way. I didn't go right to the Irish Arts Center or go right to some Irish group and try and, you know, get a job mixing cement somewhere. I just wanted to be here and on my own terms. Again, I was an individual doing my thing, going alone into the distance. And I think that wanting to do things by yourself, going out on your own in life, is a totally natural impulse that we all have as teenagers. And some of us don't let that go. We still continue to read those Ayn Rand novels. Sooner or later, you realize that you are limits to what you can do without asking other people for help. And in particular, this practice that we do, the Zazen, you know, you can learn the mechanics and you can do it. And it can be beneficial. It can certainly be beneficial to you. It can ease your mind, relieve some stress, maybe lower your blood pressure. But that's probably about it. But you're kind of bouncing on the surface there, and you don't really know you are until you are in a community of other meditators, and they help you go deeper again, and teachers help you go deeper again. And if you're in Zen, the tradition helps you go deeper again. You can't really do that with a book in your bedroom, you know. So I've jumped all over the place here. I'm practicing not reading. I've been trying to kind of like, normally I'd write, what I really would like to do is write this all out as an essay and just read it out. But that's so impersonal, I feel. So so forgive me if I'm looking on my notes here. There's a quote from Dogen that I have here again. If I can find it. Talking about this stuff is tricky because, you can learn, you can try to look for formulas and construct approaches to this practice and mistake that for the practice. And even remembering that and understanding that is also mistaking that for the practice as well. So it's really tricky stuff. It's easy to think of supporters like just clapping each other on the back and saying, you know, well done, good period, you know, or whatever. But it's much, much deeper than that. There's something really much deeper going on. And I think if you want to find out what that is necessarily, if you're new or if you haven't, if you would like to really go into it, you can't go wrong sitting Rohatsu. If you'll see, there's a poster on the board out there for Rohatsu. It's on December 7th. And it's like a Zazen Kai, an inversed Zazen Kai. Instead of getting here at 8:30 a.m., we get here at 8:30 p.m. And we sit through the night. And it's in honor of the Buddha's awakening. Traditionally, there's a week-long retreat that gets ever more intense, and I think Roshi goes down to New Mexico for that. I'm dying to do that myself. But here we do that one night, and come 3 a.m., you're sitting there, and you're like, oh, going out of your mind trying to keep awake, and the people next to you are going out of their minds to keep awake, and you can see some of the people are doing what's called the monk's dance, you know. that thing, you know. But there's an energy, there's a focus that's just, the palpable after a while, and there's nothing more palpable. There's like a snack period around 5 a.m. before we do service and stuff. And it's silent, and you can just feel the energy in the room. It's really deep. It's really strong. And irony of ironies, I've now myself become a beginning instructor. And just this past Monday, I was here, and it struck me that I really have deep, deep periods when I come here for beginning instruction. And I think it's because everyone who's come here is really earnest. They really, really want to learn, and they want to just give it a go. And often, most of them have never sat for more than 10 minutes. So when they're all amazed when 35 minutes goes by, and they're like, wow, I did 35 minutes, that's incredible. And I'm just like, yeah, you know. And their effort at keeping that, at doing that, really helps me enormously. I go really very, very deep with that. I'll never find this Dogen quote because I'm terrible at this kind of note-making thing. But, ultimately, this practice of ours, you can only do it alone, in the sense that it's just you on the cushion. But I came up with a phrase, you're alone in your not aloneness, or in your non-aloneness. And you're not alone in your aloneness. We come together as an entity, but we're all yet individuals at the same time. Dogen says in the Fugan Zazengi, he says, to carry ourselves forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self, that is enlightenment. And I think that's actually that's in actualizing the fundamental point. And I think that's the name of the fascicle. When you sit Zazen in community, others are actualizing your practice. They're making it very, very real. So, I've said all this. It's amazing. You know, the one way I like to think of community, this community, is and just to say right off the bat, I heard Fuchsia's wonderful talk from last week. She talked about a storm can come into your life at some point, and this practice makes you ready. And I thought that's very true. And I think of it as like, you know, when you come here, you get a sandbag. You get like a free sandbag, and you bring it home, you know, and you're piling them up. And when the storm comes, you got a whole bunch of sandbags, and you can put them around your house, and the water just washes over them, and it doesn't get in. And you're protected. You're protected by your practice. And that's true, because one time early on, I heard Musho give a Dharma talk. Well, it wasn't early on, because Musho, a few years ago anyway, Musho gave a talk where he said, if in doubt, you know, if in doubt, just sit. If you're in a really difficult, stressful situation, and you don't necessarily know what to do, sit. You know, why not? And when a really difficult situation came for me, this was a kind of a turning point for me, actually. Counterintuitively, I stopped and I sat Zazen. Even though what I wanted to do was go, woo, run around like a headless chicken, make telephone calls, emails, figure stuff out, plan. And that helped me take that step back, you know, from my own experience and see, you know, it put a little bit of a wedge in the chink on that armor, just wedged it open slightly more, where I could see that I'm not this panic, I'm not this fear, I'm not this person who needs to plan X, Y, or Z. I am to some degree, but I'm not. It's not the totality of everything. And I don't need to necessarily identify with one or other of those things. The Buddhas and sages, both in this world and other worlds in India and China, preserved the Buddha seal in the same way and expressed the way freely. They just practiced sitting and were protected by Zazen. Although their characters were diverse, each of them practiced the way of Zazen wholeheartedly. That's what Dogen says again in that how-to manual. What really struck me about that phrase is just practiced sitting and were protected by Zazen. And I've personally had that experience where I felt protected by my practice. I've been protected from my own reactivity. Zazen doesn't necessarily give you the magic bullet. It doesn't actually give you the magic bullet. It never really gives you answers per se, but it informs you. And as Dogen implies, it protects you. And it's kind of like we've all bought tickets on a train, and we're all on our own individual journey, but it's the same train, and it's the same set of tracks going in the same direction. I thought that up last night, thought it was cool then. But it's a good way of looking at it. It's got, I think Ryotan Sensei likes to say it's the same road, kind of like the New Jersey Turnpike. It's beautiful at times, and it sucks at times, but it's the same road. T.S. Eliot said in a beautiful poem, Burnt Norton, he said, he talks about the still point of the turning world. And I think that Sangha affords us that place, that still point, that otherwise would be very difficult to find by ourselves. I mean, we can look at the Buddha, the historical Buddha, and say, well, yeah, he did it by himself. He went off by, wandered off to that under that banyan tree and sat for a week on his own. But yeah, that was after how many years of being with other people? I mean, literally, being taught, and he had a community that poo-pooed him afterwards because he drank a bowl of milk. That's a very trite way of putting it. But I encourage those of you who may be listening to this podcast or who are here and, who don't necessarily get here all that regularly or get to a community of sitters all that regularly, if you have that scratch that can't be, that itch that can't be scratched, that what is this, who am I, what does this mean kind of thing, and it won't go away, you can't do better than just sitting with a few people. It helps. I want to close with that idea of the three jewels again. The Buddha, the awakened, we say in the precepts, the Buddha is the awakened nature of all things. The Dharma, it's the ocean of compassion and wisdom. And the Sangha, harmony. The harmony of all things. Sangha, harmony. So if you think of this here now as harmony, being harmonious with everything. In harmony, it's difficult to give in to despair and anger. And Roshi quite aptly put her finger, I think she named our current historical period very, very well as the crisis. And, we're confronted with the crisis every day. We can be protected with our Zazen. And if we don't necessarily know what to do about the crisis, there's no better place to start than just sitting. The 10th grave precept is do not defame the three treasures. And the last one being the Sangha. I think Dogen speaks to it very, very clearly when he says, I didn't write it down. I'll have to do it from memory. The teisho of the actual body is the harbor and the weir. I'm sure I wrote it down. Yes. The teisho of the actual body is the harbor and the weir. This is the most important thing in the world. Its virtue finds its home in the ocean of essential nature. It is beyond explanation. We just accept it with respect and gratitude. So I haven't been able to offer much explanation, because ultimately this practice is kind of beyond explanation. But the harbor and the weir are wonderful images. Roshi talks about it a lot, and it helped me a lot to think about it. What is a harbor? But it's a place of safety and shelter. It's where boats shelter from the storm. At the same time, Sangha is also the weir. And a weir is a number of things, actually. It can be a place where fish are nurtured, where life is nurtured. It can be a series of fences that funnel water in a certain direction. The Sangha can do that too, can help you go in a certain direction, good direction. And it's also, weirs can also be a series of fish traps, you know, where you catch fish as they jump down through the steps of a weir. And that brought to mind something I read first off the bat when I started studying Zen, out of the Dhammapada. The Buddha purportedly said, like a fish out of water thrown on dry ground, this mind thrashes about, trying to escape Mara's command. Mara is the demon of worldly desire and what have you. But we're given a safe place. This is the harbor and the weir. We're given a safe place to look at those fish that are thrown on the ground, or jump out and manifest themselves on the ground before us. You know, what the hell is that? I wanted to make a joke about Mara and Mar-a-Lago, but I couldn't figure it out. Don't give in to despair, indifference, complacency, numbness. The way presents itself through practice, especially with others. So let your practice be your harbor and your weir. And let your sangha, your community, whether it's here or whether it's in a group above a library or in your living room, let that group be your harbor and your weir.